Peter B. Collins. News and comment on Tuesday, March 13th, 2012.
We can chase down all our enemies. Bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces. But we can't bomb it into peace.
A little bit of calm has developed after a four-day conflict between Israel and Palestinians. It was started by the Israelis in a drone strike last Friday as they took out a Palestinian leader and two of his associates, and then there was the inevitable response of rockets and mortar shells fired from Palestinian positions into Israel. And we get some powerful comments from Jennifer Lowenstein, who teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin and has lived and worked in Gaza. Here is her remark, an excerpt from the in-depth interview, about this conflict between Israel and the Palestinians.
Well, I think they probably had a number of motivations for doing this. The stated motivation, which was to assassinate Zuhair al-Qaisi, to me is very suspect, because the popular resistance committees, of which she was the leader at the time, are set up as resistance organizations, and they're probably always making plans or discussing strategies the same way any military of any state is always polishing, revising plans, contingency plans, whenever there is a potential escalation of conflict between two nations. So one thing I want to stress is that when the Israeli spokespeople come on and say, we've killed this person in self-defense because they were plotting an attack on Israel, it's simply accepted at face value. Nobody questions that was or wasn't true. I haven't seen any evidence of it. I haven't heard anybody question the Israeli sources that gave out that information, and yet in the media it is immediately accepted. This is a justifiable response. That is, Israel is justified in murdering 2-3 people in a car based on evidence that none of us has any real knowledge of, that none of us can prove exists.
You can hear the full interview today at peterbcollins.com. And Lowenstein also talks about the Iron Dome, which is Israel's new missile defense system, and raises the question, did they provoke this airstrike over Gaza knowing that Palestinians would fire rockets as a way they could test the Iron Dome? Because according to Tuesday's New York Times, on the southern flank, Israel claims that it was able to intercept 54 of 70 Palestinian rockets that were aimed at Israeli cities. And this raises a question, are the Israelis using this to test out their missile defense system, a live-fire exercise over a civilian population? That's the question. I'm looking for an answer. And I have to say that the media in this country has given very little coverage to this conflict and to Israel's role, right on the heels of the big event and the summit between Obama and Netanyahu in Washington last week. And Lowenstein also offers some pretty sharp criticism of Obama, particularly for the long-term way he has managed the relationship with Israel. And while we're talking about the media, I don't consider myself to be a media critic, but I do watch certain programs critically. And last week, I was stunned because the shows that I watch on MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, I watch a little bit of Ed Schultz, I sometimes see Lawrence O'Donnell. I didn't see 5 seconds of coverage of Netanyahu's visit to Washington, of the risk of war with Iran. They just don't cover it. They're wall-to-wall on the Republican presidential campaign. And I'm interested in one story a day about Romney's latest blunder or Rick Santorum's latest sanctimonious outburst. But wall-to-wall? Is that what they think progressives want to see on the channel that is supposed to pander to us? And I guess it's working because the ratings at MSNBC have been going up, and in some time periods they're actually beating CNN. But the price is that we're being catered to in a way that keeps actual news from reaching us. There's no critical commentary on the new anti-Occupy protest law, H.R. 347. I haven't seen any coverage. Except yesterday when we cited a brief article in the Wall Street Journal. And then there's the one-year anniversary of the tsunami and the nuclear power plant meltdown at Fukushima. And I was aghast. On Sunday, I watched my local NBC-owned television station as they did a half-hour special about the tsunami and about everything except radioactive fallout and the radioactive damage caused by this unexpected and certainly cataclysmic event. And while NBC, the network, and the stations are now part-owned by Comcast, it's fair to point out that the ultimate parent of NBC is General Electric. General Electric manufactured the reactors that melted down at Fukushima. And to watch their news anchors dance around the radioactivity issue and talk about how debris is floating toward the United States and they're trying to rebuild the communities. They talked about everything but the most critical issue, which is this was a set of nuclear power plants that were severely damaged, led to massive releases of radiation that still go on today. And we haven't reformed our practices in this country at all. In fact, Obama has licensed the construction of two nuclear power plants with more than $8 billion of loan guarantees backed by you and me. I will give credit to PBS. They've been running a series on the evening news hour, which gives a full spectrum coverage, I would say, of the impact of the tsunami and the meltdown at the nuclear facilities there. But NBC won't go there. More fallout from the shooting spree conducted by an American soldier in Afghanistan on Sunday. There was a funeral held at a mosque in the Panjawi district of Kandahar province, and militants showed up on motorcycles. They attacked a high-level Afghan government delegation. And the early reports indicate that two people have been killed. And we're getting very strange coverage of the suspect in this case. We know he's from a unit that deployed out of Washington State. We know a lot about him. He's married, he has two kids, and he reported a brain injury before his last deployment. I believe he's been deployed three, perhaps four times since he first went to Iraq. Yet we don't know his name. And as Sabelle Edmonds points out in a post at Boiling Frogs Post today, we're kind of being fed a series of excuses for this man's killing spree. And why his name has not been released almost 2 days after the incident is quite curious. Meanwhile, President Obama says this will not change his strategy in Afghanistan. That was his first comment. He told a television interview Monday that it underscores the need to hand over responsibility for security to Afghans. Now that's a twisted joke, Mr. President. We know they're not ready. 60% of them are high on drugs most of the time. And since the Quran burning a few weeks back, six Americans have been killed in cold blood by Afghan uniformed soldiers or police officers. And the president's spin is belied by a New York Times report on Tuesday. I'll just read the first paragraph. The Obama administration is discussing whether to reduce American forces in Afghanistan by at least an additional 20,000 troops by 2013, reflecting a growing belief within the White House that the mission there has now reached the point of diminishing returns. Well, I reached that conclusion quite a while back, even before Obama announced his second surge of forces into Afghanistan. Well, keep up the debate there at the White House. We need it. And there are too few dissenting and outside voices being heard there. The president has surrounded himself with like-minded group thinkers, and it's about time they break that pattern. Well, it's interesting. We know that there has been a settlement with the major banks in this country, and we give credit to California's Attorney General Kamala Harris, who negotiated hard and held out for much more substantial payments from the banks. And, of course, they admit no wrongdoing, even as the attorneys general release more information about the clear wrongdoing that was conducted. And here's just one example. At Wells Fargo, employees told the inspector general's office that company management had assigned them bogus titles, including, quote, vice president of loan documentation. Even though these people had no training in document review, and before becoming vice president, one employee had worked at a pizza joint. And at J.P. Morgan Chase, they assigned bogus titles like vice president of Chase Home, even though the titles were given by Chase for the sole purpose of allowing individuals to sign documents and came with no other duties or authority. And there are still more people in the foreclosure pipeline. Now, this understanding or compromise that was negotiated may protect some people from imminent foreclosure. But understand that we're not out of the woods. We have not cleared the real toxic mortgage mess that was central to bringing on the economic problems we've had. And what we're seeing is a partial recovery. The jobs numbers are improving. The stock market is doing better. But Mike Kunzal at New Deal 2.0, publishing at truthout.org, makes a great point. He said, as the 1% reap 93% of the income gains from the recovery, we are rapidly returning to pre-New Deal levels of inequality. And when we're able to say this recession is over and look back at it, we'll see that the top 1%, while they did have some losses on the front end of this, will have the biggest gains coming out. And this will be a largely jobless recovery. Average people who don't have dividend income or non-employment income or people who can't find work, they will be the hardest hit. Republican efforts at voter suppression aimed at this November's election are hitting some roadblocks. In Texas, the new law requiring a photo ID before you can vote has been challenged by the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, and they have blocked Texas from enforcing it until court hearings can be held. And it relates to the status of Texas under the Voting Rights Act as a state that has greater responsibilities to prove that there is equal access and equal participation. And what they showed is that Texas, with about 12.8 million registered voters, 2.8 million of which are Latino, and it showed that Latino voters were at least 46% more likely to lack either a driver's license or a photo ID card that would be acceptable as identification at the polls. So I think that's a very interesting development, and we will watch this carefully to see if these efforts at voter suppression are successful in the long run. And certainly there will be some people who either don't vote or who are blocked from voting because they are unable to present ID at the time they show up at the polls. A couple of items in my email box. Over at Common Cause, they're alerting people that the Koch brothers are doing a takeover of the Cato Institute. And they have filed a lawsuit to take control of Cato and, according to Common Cause, use its tax-exempt status to promote their partisan political agenda. And I've never been a big fan of the Cato Institute, but I think it's worth noting how the wealthy in this country think that they can not only buy elections, but they can buy ideas and run a think tank that reflects their own biases and philosophies. Also in my email, a note that Antonin Scalia, one of the most conservative justices on the Supreme Court, gave a speech at Wesleyan University last week. And at the end of the speech, he took some questions. One person asked about the landmark decision 5-4 in 2000 called Bush v. Gore, where the Supreme Court chose the winner of that election and it wasn't Gore. Scalia said, "Get over it." He said, "It was a long time ago. People forget. It was a 7-2 decision. It wasn't even close." Mr. Justice, are you rewriting the outcome of that deliberation? It was 5-4. And we all know that. I'm sorry to see that you don't remember it that way. Dick Cheney will not be going to Toronto. He had planned to speak there on April 24th, but they decided that they could not provide enough security for the man with no heart. And it's based on an event last September in Vancouver, where he was holed up in the Vancouver Club for 7 hours because demonstrators had cordoned off the area and the security people didn't think it was safe for him to venture out there. I think you should just stay home, Dick. It's too risky. You travel enough, somebody is going to arrest you for war crimes. And finally today, Rush Limbaugh remains in the news as his syndicator, the Premier Radio Networks, which are owned by Clear Channel, have notified their affiliate stations that they have no commercials to run. Now, the way it works with a syndicated radio show is the syndicator and the local station split the advertising time. And typically, the national syndicator holds 5 minutes in a typical hour, and the local station has more, 7-8 minutes, somewhere in there. And I'm just going to guesstimate for you. My guess is that a 1 minute spot on the Rush Limbaugh show costs somewhere between $20,000 and $50,000. So let's go on the low end at $20,000, five of those per hour. Clear Channel is losing $100,000 an hour. That's $1.5 million a week in revenue. And so this is the real measurable fallout from Rush Limbaugh's misogynist comments. And an activist group in Los Angeles that has been dogging the outrageous hosts down there, John and Ken. John and Ken were suspended for 7 full days because of scurrilous remarks they made about Whitney Houston after she died. Rush Limbaugh has not been suspended for a minute, and they are calling for his suspension. And Clear Channel is so concerned about this that they've given this activist group in Los Angeles a radio show. Now, unfortunately, it's not going to run on the station that Rush is on, and it won't displace his program, but it will be on at the same time that Rush is on another L.A. station owned by Clear Channel. So, Rush, I think that you should prepare for your retirement. And I don't know when it will come. I am not going to hazard a prediction. But I think that we can clearly see the beginning of the end of the Rush Limbaugh non-guested confrontation talk radio concoction. Hey, thanks for listening to my concoction. Spread it far and wide. This is a free podcast, so let people hear it.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.